I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter and producer at The World covering global health. Here at The World, we've been holding a regular series of coronavirus conversations presented jointly with The Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, taking your questions to the experts. This discussion series is featured on our Facebook page, but we wanted to share what we think are really valuable conversations with you right here in The World's podcast feed. This week, I spoke with William Hanich, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, about the pandemic and the latest updates as we approach the holiday season.
To start, in the United States, more than 200,000 people have died of COVID-19. The number of new cases is growing by some 50,000 each day. It's a figure that's been rising for 4 weeks running and is up by more than a third since just a month ago. It's hard to believe. The fear is that this is just a preview of what the late fall and winter might hold. Cold weather sends people indoors. We could see much more dramatic rises in COVID cases with winter holidays coming. And that's also creating really difficult, heart-wrenching dilemmas for many families. Do you travel even to places and communities where there are lots of infections or to and from? So to begin, William, where do you see us now in this progression of the pandemic? And where do you see it headed?
Well, you're right that there are increases happening at the moment. In fact, I think that 17 states reported record highs in cases just last night. However, it's worth noting where they are. The states which are currently seeing the most activity are mostly in the Midwest, and these are sparsely populated states. However, the numbers there do add up. So at the moment, this is what we're seeing. We're seeing continued pandemic activity at low levels among places which have experienced a reasonable amount of it already, and then more intense activity, especially in some of these small towns in the heartland. And that's what's happening right now. It's a bit early, I think, to be saying that we are seeing the start of what's going to happen in the fall, but we do anticipate there to be more, to be the shifting indoors to places where transmission is more likely to be felt in the end. And I think that we are seeing the impact of that in some European countries. So that provides us a little bit of a window into the future.
So when you see these high numbers in cases being reported now, more so than the past, are you saying that most of that we're really seeing in some of these Midwestern states right now?
Yes, at the moment it is. It's also worth noting that testing has got a lot better. So when we're watching these sort of epidemic curves increasing, we're seeing them in way more detail than we did back in the spring. So, the ratio of sort of cases to the actual amount of pandemic activity underlying it is now much more clearly defined. We're getting much more clear insight into what happens with milder cases, for instance.
And so are you seeing any sort of signs of, as people move indoors or as holidays come up, of what sorts of risks that poses and how we might see this play out?
Yeah. So I think the one thing that is really helpful to think about is, we can think about preventing pandemic transmission and in particular preventing clusters of transmission. Because remember, this is a virus which tends to transmit in clusters. It tends to infect a number of people at one time. Japan fairly early on came up with this notion of the three C's, which are three C's which can be avoided if you want to avoid cluster formation. And those three C's are closed spaces, close contact, and crowding. And it's fairly easy to see how those three could easily be, could easily come all together when it comes to the holidays. So, poorly ventilated indoor spaces are a risk for transmission. We also know that a further risk for transmission is eating. We have a report from a few weeks ago from CDC indicating fairly clearly that people who had been eating indoors in a restaurant in the last few weeks were, that was associated with testing positive. So putting all this together, I'm afraid that you can see that the coming holidays are going to be, they have the potential to be a real serious problem in terms of facilitating transmission.
And so I think that at the same time, there's also people are experiencing a fatigue with this going on for such a long period. And the holidays maybe seem like a time we're just coming up to be able to be with loved ones. And at the same time, just in general, when it comes to the ways that public health has really been stressing from people like you about this kind of C's or about the mask wearing and things like that. How do you manage the fatigue of this continuing? And it seems like, is there a shift to kind of people being more willing to just live with the risks and live with this virus and what that means?
Yeah, I think that you are completely right. And I want to start by pointing out that, yeah, I understand the feeling of pandemic fatigue. I feel myself. I, was very good for months not touching my face, and I increasingly find myself touching my face. The thing is that I think what we needed early on was for people to be straight up about what this is. This is a pandemic. It's of the kind which has not really been seen in about 100 years. And so the response to it will need to be coordinated and sustained. Now, that doesn't mean that it has to be intense, okay? One of the things which makes me and my colleagues really quite tired is when we hear people saying, oh, you're talking about lockdown to a vaccine. No, that's not true. That's just simply not true. You need very strong interventions if you lose control of the pandemic. That's the situation. So what you actually want to do is to maintain a bunch of interventions of the kind which you've described, like, thinking about the three C's, thinking about mask use, thinking about reducing risk in a way that you can sustain. This doesn't mean you have to stay in your home continuously. What it means is that you come up with ways in which you are able to avoid losing control, because losing control of the pandemic is the last thing anybody wants to happen, because it's that then leads to a threat to healthcare and the sort of surges that we saw in the Northeast in the spring and, over the summer in the Sun Belt. So that's what the first goal needs to be. The first goal needs to be avoiding surges. And I think that you can do that, provided you are prepared to put in milder interventions at an earlier stage of the epidemic curve. But we have to remember, this is the start of a winter, which is likely to be really very difficult. I think we can get through it, but I can't sugarcoat it. It's not going to be fun.
So then how do you weigh those risks and think about that with the holidays approaching?
That's a really, really, really good question. I think that people are obviously going to be making decisions for themselves. I think that it's helpful to remember a few things about the virus. You often hear that it is, you hear that it's either incredibly dangerous to everybody or that it's not dangerous to anybody. Neither are true. It is overwhelmingly clear that among the very youngest people, the under 20s, they are much, much less likely to suffer severe disease. I mean, there's not zero. I mean, we know that there are syndromes which are rare, and if you infect enough people in that age group, you will see them. But they're much less likely to suffer the most severe consequences of disease. But that increases as you get older. It really increases extremely rapidly, exponentially. And so if you're looking at people who are, around the age of, 50, 60, 70, it becomes extremely high. And, those people are at real risk. If large numbers become infected, we have a problem in healthcare. Again, if large numbers of people younger than that become infected, we have a problem in healthcare. So I think that when people are figuring out how to do this, they're going to have to make decisions about how to protect those people who are most vulnerable. And that's something which I would really encourage everybody to think about going forward.
So you mean considering whether or not if a younger person were to visit an older family member?
Yeah, I think that having a younger... One of the things that we know for a fact at the moment is that we often see the initial stages of these epidemic curves being driven by mild infections in the adolescents and 20-somethings. Now, those are not even necessarily noticed in particular because they're much less likely to experience symptoms. They're much less likely to go and get a test unless they're getting something for another reason. And then these individuals have the capacity to transmit to older, more at-risk individuals. And once it gets, and that can happen despite people's best efforts. We know that, I can think of particular settings where people have worked really, really hard to avoid the virus getting into them, and they still get in there, nevertheless. And I'm not even talking about the White House. I'm talking about places which are like long-term care facilities. People work really hard, and yet still you have to be alert for the virus.
This question comes from Maria. You mentioned that young people are less impacted, but of the kids who have died, most have been children of color. Why and how can we better protect them, especially with kid-friendly holidays approaching like Halloween?
That's an incredibly good question. And it's great also because it gets us into a discussion about Halloween. You're completely correct that children of color, and indeed, if you like adjust rates of death for age, indeed the risk of death for at younger age groups, including people of working age, is much higher among communities of color. That's absolutely the case. Why it is not altogether clear. I mean, the fact is we have to recognize that the pandemic is happening against the background of systemic racism. And so we have a situation in which we're finding there's probably a far higher exposure to the virus among some communities. That's partially because those communities are overrepresented in sort of essential workers. So, and perhaps are living in, you know, more crowded conditions. You can see, indeed, if you look at the sort of halo of cases when it comes to, you know, COVID cases and deaths in the outer boroughs of New York City, you can see that, you know, some communities are disproportionately hit. Now, that's the first part of the question. The next is how to protect. And I think that this is something which you want to, I mean, the Halloween issue is a huge issue, including within my own household. Now, remember what I said about the three C's, you know, closed spaces, crowding, close contact. Well, if you're not in a huge crowd trick or treating, you know, you're not really meeting any of those three. If you're able to be outdoors, if you're able to sort of pick up candy with minimal contact with the people you're talking to, and, you know, even more so if you're wearing a mask, then those are things which I think can really reduce the risk. I would advise against crowded Halloween events, but I do think that those sorts of things could really help. I've also heard, although I don't quiz me on this because it's not something I'm an expert in, I've heard of something called trunk or treat, which involves people in their cars getting putting things in the trunk of them in a parking lot. But you know, I would recommend looking that up on the internet rather than getting it from.
Look things up on the internet. Okay.
No, but don't believe everything you hear on the internet. That's the other thing.
This question comes from Teresa. I'm kind of drilling into some specific questions that people have. Going back to, for example, visiting family members, or the question is about what about basic temporary modifications in the home, like putting a plexiglass divider on a dining room table to protect during the holiday meal? Or do you have other ideas?
I think the plexiglass divider is probably going somewhat, somewhat too far. I think the most important thing is ventilation. Ventilation, you know, indoors in poorly ventilated areas. And I will encourage people to talk to my colleague Joe Allen about ventilation, because I'm an infectious disease sort of, you know, expert rather than a ventilation expert. But I think that ventilation really does help, but it doesn't necessarily need a huge amount in order to be beneficial. Opening a window 6 inches, putting some fans in order to enable air to flow through, that will really reduce the risk of transmission. And yeah, it may be somewhat cold in the room, but you know, this is an opportunity to get out those kind of full sweaters that we all like to wear. And you know, I know, you know, speaking personally, I, you know, try to dress up warm while we're eating outside. So things like that can help. If you're going to be doing things indoors with family members, some people might also consider getting tested beforehand, and that's not a bad idea. But I do think you should not. It shouldn't be something that you then test negative and you go, oh, that's fine, I don't need to wear a mask. No, that's not true. If you take the test and you then wear a mask, that's this kind of combined approach that, you know, taking them together is much more effective than doing them sort of in isolation.
I just want to follow up on that and then hear your final thought, because this question from Hal asks, you know, if people quarantine for 14 days, before seeing a family member and get tested for the virus in the last few days, that way they could be safer. Does that seem sound? Does that then also require the opening of the windows and everything else? Or where does that fit?
That would minimize the risk. I mean, essentially, there was my friend Ian McKay, who's an Australian virologist, recently put up a really neat idea for how
the Swiss cheese.
Yeah. So you have the Swiss cheese, which you imagine like slices of cheese and the little holes in them. And each one of them is an intervention. It's either, you know, opening the windows, or it's getting tested, or it's wearing a mask, or quarantining. Quarantining for 14 days is particularly a strong one. But if you imagine the virus trying to get through, it might get through one, but it won't get through all of them. And that's a really, really, I think, helpful way of thinking about it. And it also is useful because we have a natural desire to, for there to be a silver bullet. And I'm afraid there isn't a silver bullet. There isn't. But that doesn't mean we are without ammunition. And it means that the stuff that we do have, if we use it all together, can, you know, can be beneficial. But we have to remember that it's not just one thing.
So what do you do about teens coming back from college? This question comes from Lester, even if they're screened at school before flying home.
That's interesting. It depends on the college, I would say, to a large extent. I mean, remember that just because people have tested negative at one point doesn't mean they're not going to turn positive shortly after. Indeed, it's an emerging consensus that people are most infectious around about the time they develop symptoms. So even though you've had a lot of negative tests, the fact that that doesn't necessarily mean that the next test is not going to be positive. Having said that, I know that there are some colleges, Colby has so far been doing very well. I know that other places which have really intense testing procedures where they're sort of doing like two tests a week for students living in dorms, it appears that the students living in dorms have a lower sort of incidence and prevalence of disease than the community as a whole. So that could be really very helpful. Again, if you get them back, still think about the masks. There was another really interesting paper that came out a couple of weeks ago. Again, this is an outbreak investigation, so they was always come with a little bit of a, they should come with the caveat that outbreaks are not necessarily representative of all cases. You have to remember cases where outbreaks did not occur. But it was very interesting. It was a multi-day gathering with multiple family members, multiple households gathering together, and all but two of the people who were sharing the space indoors became infected. However, there was also a meeting with another family who came and spent 10 hours on one day with the rest of them and 3 hours on the next, and none of them became infected, but that was entirely outdoors. So once again, these large clustered events, you know, it ends up with things like weddings or, you know, things where different groups of people are together in close contact for relatively long periods of time with lots of opportunities for transmission. And even if you cannot cut it to zero, you can really reduce the risk a lot by taking some of the steps which I outlined.
So this question comes from Christina. Are we any closer to rapid antigen screening tests? I know part of this conversation wanted to get to updates in testing, and I think the implication there is rapid.
Yeah, rapid tests. We are. There are a number of companies which are starting to offer that. Abbott, for instance. We have to remember, though, when we're using them, we have to be smart when we're using them. For a start, you should never use them and then think, okay, I don't need a mask. Okay, that's not the reason. The idea is that if you are positive, you're able to isolate yourself really, really quickly. So those are beginning to become available.
Wait, explain that, because if you are positive, it means it's very sensitive to detecting.
Well, actually, some of the antigen tests are not necessarily that sensitive. But if you have a sensitive but highly specific test, so that you don't get very many false positives, then what that means is that if you turn up positive and you then immediately isolate yourself, you can be pretty sure that you really do have it. On the other hand, if you come negative and you're still wearing a mask, even though you're actually positive, the risks of transmission are immediately cut. And when you put that together with things like, if we're thinking about producing droplets and aerosols, I'm producing a whole load of droplets and aerosols right now because I'm talking. Now, if I was wearing a mask, many of them would be caught. Now, however, that's a really important thing, because if you imagine people in a setting where they're like wearing a mask, but they're not talking and they've gone through an rapid antigen test, then, you know, I can easily imagine people going to a movie theater, perhaps, sitting maybe not at full capacity, but you can imagine cutting that down. And if the community prevalence is low enough that you're not really likely to be having very many people transmitting in the movie theater, that's something which is actually imaginable. But one of the key things is keeping that community prevalence down.
This question comes from Melissa, and it's a question that I think has been more top of mind because of some recent news, but how long after recovery from COVID-19 are you immune to reinfection?
That's a very good question. At the moment, it's not clear. There are definitely some cases of reinfection. we have investigated them, how significant they are, how often they happen, and whether or not the people who have them are going to suffer more mild disease or more serious disease, or how much they are likely to transmit, because you might be infected again but be less infectious. Those are all currently unknowns. What we do know is that if you look at the antibody titers, you know, we have different types of antibodies, IgG, IgM, etc. You can see them waning over time, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we are not immune, because we have memory, and we have immune memory. And so if the body encounters coronavirus again, it may be able to mount, we would hope it would be able to mount, a very strong immune response. So I would say, based on my, this is not something which I know for sure, and you'll understand why, because we haven't had that much time to be able to sort of see what happens with this. But based on the study of other coronaviruses, other beta coronaviruses, the mild ones, I would suggest that most people would be reasonably immune up to about a year after they've had it, and that some would not be. And that obviously over time, the number of people who do not have immunity would increase. So I don't think we have any reason to think that it will be lifelong. And certainly we have evidence to show that it's definitely not lifelong in all people.
This question comes from Sam. There's just a lot of really specific, interesting questions coming in this way, but I do want to zoom back out as we near the end of the conversation. When you think about travel during this time and around holidays, are airplanes a way to go even without social distancing? How do you navigate that?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, and it's a tough one, but I think that we can get some answers when we think about you can get some answers indeed going back to some of the earliest stuff we got from this. When the WHO did its joint mission to Wuhan with China, the team that went there actually enacted a lot of the kind of measures that we've become familiar with. They were fully masked. When they went into meetings, they sat a large distance apart from each other indoors, and they used microphones so they weren't talking loudly, producing lots of aerosols. And then when they were traveling, they would sit on the bus. They would not sit next to each other. In fact, I think, as I recall correctly, that there was like one person per row, possibly even less. So if you're distancing yourself through in that way, then that again limits the opportunities for transmission. So once again, ventilation is an issue. That's hard to get on a plane. But at the moment, it's difficult to know exactly how many people are necessarily using air travel. We expect it to go up for the holidays, naturally. I would suggest that if you're doing it, you take the sort of usual precautions that you would, sit as far apart from others as you can, wearing masks, hand sanitizing, all of that sort of thing. And, you know, these are, again, steps which are not necessarily designed to eliminate infection or the risk of infection, but to reduce it. And, you know, if that happens and you did become infected, the majority of people will make a recovery, but you don't want to transmit it to somebody who's at high risk. So when you get off, you know, remember to continue those interventions which are designed to stop you transmitting. So masks, etc.
These are two questions that I want to bring in that have to do also with risks. For particular people. So I want to combine. One is from Lisa. It asks, are healthy individuals age 70 to 80 automatically at higher risk because of their age for coronavirus? And the other question is from Joyer. Do genes have anything to do with the severity or mildness of COVID-19 symptoms?
So I'll tell you the first one of those first. It appears that is actually the case, although it's quite difficult that people are sicker simply or more at risk of the most of their outcomes simply on the basis of being older. The extent to which it's true or the extent to which it's influenced by the presence of other comorbidities is not clear, but it does seem that there is a risk independent of those comorbidities. And you can see this indeed if you look at the fact that the risk of death starts to increase for people in their mid-40s. You know, if you're in your 50s and you contract COVID, your probability of dying is roughly speaking about 200 times the risk per year that you would die in a road traffic accident. And it goes up even further after that. And, you know, not all people in their 40s necessarily have this comorbidity. When it comes to genes, we are beginning to see some evidence that there are some particular issues to do in particular with interferon gamma, which is one of the body's natural responses for dealing with viral infections, which could have something to do with the severity of the infection. But I would sort of say that I've not read enough on that to be happy to talk a great deal more about it.
Sure. Going back to, you mentioned places like Wuhan, that in examining, for example, early on with the WHO, kind of the measures that were taken there, Wuhan and China is also a place where there's just massive testing of cities, for example, when there's believed to be an outbreak. This question from Gary asks, why hasn't the world copied what China has done and continues to do?
Well, China did more than that, it's fair to say. China also did enforced quarantine to an extent which I think many places would struggle to deal with in terms of civil liberties. What China did also demonstrate, and what I read as being like the central message of that report, is that with a great deal of testing, with, you know, enough attention to it, and acted quickly enough, you can actually stop it to the point where you can resume fairly normal activity. And it's not just China that's done that. You can look at a lot of places, most of them islands, which haven't done something similar. You can see Iceland, New Zealand, although even Australia has been very successful. So, but beyond that, there are multiple sort of pandemic management strategies which are apparently more effective than what we've been trying to look at here. I would encourage people to go look at Japan. Japan has a relatively old society. It has many people at risk. It had an early introduction, and it has not necessarily done a huge amount of testing. It's done some, but not a huge amount. On the other hand, its death rate per million at the moment, it's 13 per million. And the equivalent for the United States is over 660. So I would suggest that people look at places like Japan to get some insight for how you can have a long-term sustainable pandemic response, which doesn't risk, you know, widespread death.
And again, one of the things that you talked about with Japan is kind of this focus on clusters.
Yes, absolutely. Japan very early on initiated a cluster busting sort of route for contact tracing. So, right, you know, the majority of people who are infected with COVID don't transmit. However, the minority that do transmit more than make up for it. So what that means is that if you're looking for forward contact tracing to get, you know, the people who are going to be infected by somebody you've just identified, most of them won't be transmitting. However, if you've got somebody who is infected, you know that they got it from somewhere. And if you don't know where that is, it's probably a good idea to find it, because it's probable that that person transmitted to somebody else given the opportunity.
I want to get back to this notion as moving into the holiday season, but also to what degree are you finding that some of these recommendations or even measures around coronavirus and COVID prevention have become partisan? Because I can see this also playing out around how measures are and aren't taken in places with high rates of infections or potentially fueling more infections as well.
Yeah, that's a really, really great question. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, people listening to this cannot have failed to notice that we live in an incredibly divided partisan time. And science isn't partisan. You know, the virus isn't partisan, it just is. And, you know, we try to understand as best we can, you know, what we can do to, you know, fight it. And those of us who advise politicians tell the politicians what the consequences of their actions are likely to be. And it's up to the politicians to decide if they're okay with that. Now, unfortunately, we also have a situation where it is possible for one person via a public pronouncement to instantly divide us between those who are going to agree with them or disagree with them, regardless of the actual circumstance and the actual consequences. And you can see some of this in like the discussion around schools. Unfortunately, it's not the case that schools can and should remain closed under all circumstances forever, nor is it the case that schools should be open under all circumstances wherever. Instead, there is a shades of grey in between, and what actually works best will depend a lot on local conditions. So we need to be a little bit more, you know, we need to recognize that. And those of us in my position, you know, just need to keep giving the straight don't as straight as we can.
I just want to check because we're wrapping up, but do you have some time to stick with us for a few more questions?
How many?
Got like three.
Okay, let's go with three. I just realized we're matching. We're very, but basically, it wasn't planned.
So do you foresee restricted travel between states if surges continue in specific areas? This is from Maggie.
If surges continue, I think that would be quite likely. The crucial thing about travel in a pandemic is that if you're traveling between places which basically have the same prevalence and you're equally likely to get infected in either, then it's really, you know, no big deal. But if you're traveling from somewhere with very high prevalence and you might introduce it somewhere with very low prevalence, think again of those small towns in the heartland, then that's something that you should be concerned about. And vice versa, if you travel from somewhere with low to somewhere with high, then you're running the risk of becoming infected. I know of clusters of infections here in Massachusetts that were kicked off by people who are returning from Florida in the summer, for instance. But if those things continue and you get big differences in terms of prevalence between different regions, yeah, I would not be at all surprised to see travel restrictions.
What about recommendations? This is from Jill about non-emergency healthcare if your community is experiencing a surge. Should those things be delayed?
If you're experiencing a surge, yes. That's one of the reasons why we want to avoid a surge. We often talk about protecting healthcare, and people seem to think about healthcare collapsing as being a hospital, like, you know, just crumbling and falling to the ground. That's not what we mean. What we mean is those other parts of healthcare, which are really important, like, you know, cancer screenings, or chronic disease checkups, those we want to be able to continue as well. But if you have a situation where the risk of people coming in there is like you're going to be potentially exposing those individuals, and you have a situation where, and as this was the case in the spring in some places, where you reach a situation where every single ICU bed in your hospital network is occupied by a COVID patient, that's something that's something which is going to get in the way of those as well. And it's all about keeping it under control. What we don't want to see is uncontrolled transmission, because the consequences of that for healthcare are really severe, even before it gets to the worst.
Outside of uncontrolled transmission and the consequences for healthcare, there has been some conversations entering some policy discussions around the globe of what happens if it's beyond control in communities, and might there be a benefit to that, those infections reaching a level of exposure? As an epidemiologist, what do you see as being beneficial or problematic about that?
I think it's truly incredibly problematic. I mean, some people, and very, very few, I should add, have taken to suggesting that it is possible to just encourage infections, encourage losing control of infections in such a way that those who are relatively low risk become infected very rapidly and they build up levels of immunity. There are multiple problems with this. The first is that it relies upon the fiction that you are able to completely protect those older at-risk networks. I mean, the metaphor that I use is it's akin to a wildfire sweeping down a valley, and you decide to take all of your antiques and put them in a house and just encourage the wildfire outside in the valley so it burns quickly through, and then you can come out, and that you're just going to stand inside with a bucket of water splashing it onto any sparks that manage to get in. It's not sustainable. It also has to be noted that the risks of serious infection in younger people, while much lower, are not nil. And we are just beginning to learn about the long-term consequences of this. I think that even if only a relatively small fraction of those hospitalized are, develop long-term chronic conditions, that's going to be a burden on the healthcare system for a long time to come. And doing this at a point when we are, hopefully, I don't think that anybody is, I will not tell you, nobody can tell you exactly when a vaccine will be available. And anybody who says they can is lying. But hopefully we can be looking at some point next year when we would be able to have some kind of measure of protection in a controlled fashion and not in an uncontrolled fashion.
This question is from, I'm just squeezing in a few more questions. I hope that's okay. From Amy, how can people stay safe when they're standing in long lines to vote?
Great question, Amy. If you're standing in long lines to vote, you should hopefully, for a large part of that, be outside. And transmission outside is vastly, vastly lower than the risk of transmission inside. So a large part of that should be the outside, wrap up warm. If you are then going in to vote, remember, even if you're indoors, if it's in a well-ventilated space and mask use is present, then that's something that you're still controlling. And if you're voting quickly, you know, people, the official CDC definition of close contact is within 6 feet for 15 minutes. Few people spend 15 minutes in the voting booth. So what you can do is if you are able to get in there, you know, cast your ballot, leave, apply hand sanitizer, the risks of transmission will be very low. And again, remember that the risks of transmission, you know, even if younger people become infected, then the majority make a full recovery. The concern is that the minority is still a large enough number for us to worry about. So I hope that I'm really hoping that we're going to be able to see as much participation in person in the election as possible.
Finally, I just want to wrap up with we started with where you see the pandemic right now. And again, where do you see it going moving into the winter, the fall and winter, and how much of that is determined by what people or how policies navigate the holidays?
Well, the holidays in particular will be extremely important. We've known this for some time. One of my sort of favorite little epidemiological nuggets of information is that if you look at invasive pneumococcal disease, which is it's a disease which is caused by a bacteria called the pneumococcus, in older people, there's a spike, you know, year after year after the holidays. And that's because of the fact that older people get together with younger people over the holidays, and the younger people, who tend to be the core group for transmitting this bacteria, transmit to their grandparents. Hmm. So that's just something we've known about for decades. If you look at that in the context of a pandemic virus, it's a real matter for concern. Now, right now, I don't think that we are seeing the predictable increase quite yet that we expect to come from people being indoors, but we do expect to see more of it as people are driven indoors by the weather. You know, the South may have a relatively good time because of the fact that it'll be easier for people to gather outdoors, you know, in fact, easier than it was during the heat of the summer. So we do expect to see that, and we do expect to see increases associated with the holidays. If you look at, there were increases following Memorial Day. If you look at New York City recently, there's a strong argument to be made that the High Holy Days were followed by an increase in transmission, but caused by people getting together.
Around New York, you mean?
Yes, yeah, in some of the outer boroughs of New York. It's so these things are really predictable. We know that it's going to happen. But we do have a situation where it's kind of like choose your own pandemic. What you do has a major impact, you know, you personally, and what your, you know, what policymakers do as well. There are things that can be done that will slow the spread. There are things that can be done which are sustainable. You know, I honestly would say that, you know, I know that some people object very strongly to wearing masks. I'll be frank, I can't understand why you would wish to object so strongly to something if you're able to protect other people from from your own infection that you may or may not have. I just don't understand it. However, all of these things taken together can do something to help the pandemic. And we have got a long winter ahead of us. I'm not going to tell you that it's going to be fun, but I do think that there's you know, light amidst the darkness. We have testing in such a way that the situational awareness is really much better than it was in the spring. So we're going to be so much better prepared in order to be able to take action if we need to. So, you know, I have hope, but I do think that it's going to take, you know, it does take real leadership to bring people along with you.
That was William Hanage, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. This Q&A was jointly presented by the Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and us here at The World. You can find the video of this discussion on our Facebook pages, @ForumHSPH and @PRI The World. And see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Thanks for listening.
From PRX.